Welcome.
You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith, featuring the April 2024 Opera with Opera News magazine. We'll begin by continuing Child's Play. For me, it is the latter, so that after you have absorbed absolutely all the vocal and orchestral parts, you feel the music completely all the time. Then you don't need to try and prepare in the way you have done with the other operas you have sung before. J.T. Might that make it easier to adapt to very different productions of Pelléas et Mélisande than could perhaps be the case when you were singing more traditionally structured operas? F.L.R. In theory, yes, but always in practice one has to feel an identification with the director's view if you are going to feel comfortable singing in the production. And for me, that director must understand Debussy's music. I am very open to ideas. The Strasser production was very controversial when it first appeared, and I loved it. When I did the production of Peter Sellers in Los Angeles, I just adored working with him because he is so incredibly a connoisseur of Debussy's world. Of course, he likes his singers to improvise, but he is very precise about the psychological details, and he has a profound response to the tragedy in this opera. I saw him completely in tears during some of the rehearsals. He also had a very interesting point about the fatalism in the story, the element that Debussy had spoken of a few years before discovering Maeterlinck's play, when he had said that an ideal opera libretto for him would be a subject where the characters do not have control over their fate. There is especially one place in the opera that I have always felt says a lot about this, about what could have happened. In Act 2, Scene 2, after Golo asks Mélisande whether she wants to leave him, she replies, "Je voudrais m'en aller avec vous. C'est ici que je ne peux plus vivre." I would like to go away with you. It's here that I cannot live any longer. I think if they had not come back to Allemande, they would not have had any problem. Peter Sellers said to us that it's also the problem of Golod's ancient grandfather, Arkel, keeping power as the king, so Golod, in a way, is like the prince consort. He has no power. He doesn't know if his future is going to happen here in the castle. And so, why come back? It's the hold of Arkel and the castle over him that seals his fate and prevents him starting a proper new life. J.T. From the point of view of having sung both Pelléas and Golod, was your view of Pelléas changed at all by taking on Golod? F.L.R. No, absolutely not. In a way, I did with Golod exactly what I had done with Pelléas. Although he sang it magnificently on the famous recording with Irene Joachim, I was not satisfied with what I had seen of Jacques Janson Pelléas. For me, it was too distanced, and with all the Golods I had seen, including even the greatest artists that I had admired so much, I could not understand how a Mélisande would follow a Golod if he was so very frightening. Of course, he has to be frightening. Terribly so, sometimes, but he has to play that he is really in love with Mélisande. And although he is living in a world of fantasy, there is something really strong about his love. When he keeps pressing Mélisande on her deathbed for the truth, I think he wants to find out, what is love? I've been wrong all my life about love. If love was what you had with Pelléas, what is it? So in the case of singing both Pelléas and Golod, I was concerned not to duplicate what I had seen, and just because I took on Golod, I did not start to see Pelléas differently, being sung as he was by someone else. On the contrary, I have always felt the same way about his fundamental personality. The last part of the fourth act reveals him most completely of all to me. When he and Mélisande realize that Golod is watching them from behind a tree, and he sings, "Va-t'en, va-t'en, tout de suite par ici, Je l'attendrai. Je l'arrêterai. Go away. Go now at once. This way. I'll wait for him. I'll keep him off. He isn't pushing her vigorously to get away. He's calm and gentle. Go. I'll stay. For me, that is the force of Peleas. All the time he stays in his same humanity. He isn't changing into a violent, smaller half-brother of Golod. Even when I am teaching Peleas, I find new elements that actually confirm what I had found when I first sang the role. It's always just more precise. For instance, the first music of the opera that Debussy wrote in the Act 4 love scene, On dirait que ta voix a passé sur la mer au printemps. It's as though your voice had come over the sea in the spring. When I first sang it, I immediately felt there was something unique about this phrase, but I couldn't explain it. Now I can. The words, On dirait que ta voix a passé sur la mer, are a perfect alexandrine. A 12-syllable line of verse used frequently in French poetry. And then you have Au printemps. Debussy has made those words of the alexandrine into one long phrase, and then you have just Au printemps, dropping down in pitch and closing the phrase so delicately, like an inspired afterthought. Then he goes on to sing, Je ne l'ai jamais entendu jusqu'à ici. On dirait qu'il a plu sur mon cœur. I have never heard it until today. It is as though it has rained on my heart. The shape in which Debussy has written this is, for me, the poetry of Peleas' character and the poetry of Debussy and Maeterlinck, and it should always be sung poetically. J.T. And it's the poetry of Peleas' love that Golod lacks and cannot accept in his younger half-brother? FLR, indeed, and that is why it is so painful to play Golod. If you do it really well, I hope I did it well, it really wounds you, and it's dangerous. He's dangerous to himself, he's dangerous to the entire household, and in such sinister music. In this opera, Debussy has given us the most intense depth and realism of human situations, no matter how symbolic the environment is. And right from the very beginning, its main theme is there. Everyone is lost. Do you know of any other opera that begins with a character saying he doesn't know where he is and he doesn't know what he's going to do? Reader's Letters. Recouping Losses. Further to the fascinating article on Parsifal, March, pages 300 to 308, it would be good to recall that the first concert performances of Parsifal at the Royal Albert Hall on November 8th and 15th, 1884, were probably the first given outside Germany. They were presumably given with authorization, since the principal roles were sung by Heinrich Wilhelm Gudehus, Therese Malton, and Emil Skariam, who had all sung in the first or early Bayreuth performances of 1882. The RAH performance of the 8th was designated an open dress rehearsal. Wagner himself had conducted parts of The Ring in 1877 at the RAH, and with many of the original singers, in an attempt to recoup the large losses of the first Ring. Sent in by Richard Copeman via email. Mind the Gap. I must say I found David Chandler's article, Filling the Gap, February 2024, pages 159 to 63, to be an interesting read. For some reason, it put me in mind of a conversation I had many years ago with a Swedish gentleman while I was a student hitchhiking in his country. He said something that I've always regarded as a considerable compliment, namely, that the English, or it might have been the British, have the characteristic of being able to laugh at themselves. I've never forgotten this remark, and I do think it has some relevance to Chandler's article. Quite rightly, for example, he refers to Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, which, in terms of the satirical content, I think is hard to beat. When, for example, has the political satire in Iolante been matched, let alone bettered? It might well be true that, in purely musical terms, this country had nothing in the 19th and early 20th centuries to compare with Wagner's Verdi or Puccini. It is also true that, again in purely musical terms, Gilbert and Sullivan might not bear too close comparison with Johann Strauss, Lehár, or Offenbach. On the other hand, in terms of the humor involved, matters are surely the other way around. By the way, on the subject of operetta, I was a little surprised Chandler did not mention Edward German's Merry England, very much in the GNS mode, I think, sent in by John Corkindale, New Malden, Surrey. How strange that David Chandler does not include Stephen Storace among the 18th-century British composers he mentions in his sometimes polemical Filling the Gap. Perhaps he didn't feel that Storace was English enough because his father was Italian. But this talented composer was born and died young in London. Do the two Viennese opere buffe, I Malcontenti, and the outstanding Gli Equivoci, with a libretto by De Ponte, put him out of court? Even so, how about the English operas, The Haunted Tower, No Song, No Supper, Dido, Queen of Carthage, The Pirates, The Cherokee? His sister Nancy is, of course, known to all Mozart lovers, but Stephen should not be forgotten. Sent in by Adam Pollock via email. Monopolies and mergers. In 1826, the St. Petersburg Theater Directorate became a part of the Ministry of the Imperial Court, and to this was added the Moscow Directorate in 1852. As a result, the Aleksandrinsky, Mikhailovsky, Bolshoi, and Mariinsky theaters in St. Petersburg, and the Bolshoi and Mali in Moscow, came under state control. The directorate controlled all aspects of theatrical life in the capitals through the Statute of the Prevention and Suppression of Crimes. Following many petitions from the likes of the playwright Alexander Ostrovsky and the Mali theater actress Anna Brenko, Tsar Alexander III instructed the Senate on March 24, 1882, to abolish the monopoly enjoyed by the imperial theaters. The appointment of Valery Gergiev, who has given vocal support to President Putin, to run the Moscow Bolshoi in addition to the St. Petersburg Mariinsky, as well as being appointed chairman of the Coordinating Council that controls all large cultural institutions, raises the question, has Russia now culturally returned to a pre-1882 system of theater control? Sent in by John Nelson via email. And now follow the swallow. Ditlev Rendum on the original La Rondinée. La Rondinée is a real disaster, so declared Puccini in November 1914 in an outpouring of frustration to his librettist Giuseppe Adami as he worked on the third act. I cursed the day when I made a contract with the Viennese. Puccini's words have subsequently been leveled at the opera with depressing regularity. Premiered in Monte Carlo in March 1917 under the baton of Gino Marinuzzi, La Rondinée soon appeared in major theaters across Italy and South America, finally reaching New York's Metropolitan Opera in 1928. But it was not until the late 20th century that Puccini's Commedia Lyrica began to secure a more regular place in the international repertory, almost invariably in the version of the opera preserved in its first edition. La Rondinée is, in fact, almost unique among Puccini's operas in the scale of revision he undertook after the work's initial publication. Only Edgar and Madama Butterfly are perhaps as complex. The bittersweet tale of a courtesan, Magda, who impulsively abandons her life in Paris for an innocent younger man, Ruggiero, and the Côte d'Azur. The work delighted its first public in sunny Monaco. It also became a launchpad for the soprano Gilda Dalla Rizza, who appeared alongside the tenor Tito Schipa at the premiere. But barely a year after the opera's debut, Puccini began making major revisions that resulted in a second edition unveiled in Palermo in early 1920 and presented in German in Vienna later that year. Here, Magda's eventual decision to leave Ruggiero and return to her old life is instigated directly by her Parisian friend, the poet Prunier, who persuades her to leave Ruggiero without a final farewell. Prunier was also transformed from a tenor into a baritone, bringing the main ensemble closer to that of La Bohème, 1896. Yet not long after this Viennese run, Puccini was hit by further doubts and now returned to the original scenario and voice types of 1917, while turning the denouement into a brutal rejection of Magda after Ruggiero learns of her past. Neither of these two published revisions enjoyed public success, and the third edition was never even performed in Puccini's lifetime. It was, as Puccini remarked to Dalla Rizza in June 1923, a real shame that one of my most sincere pieces of music is allowed to fall into obscurity. Yet the compositional history of La Rondine is considerably more complex than this brief outline suggests, and it is only now becoming clearer. One of the consequences of Rondine's Viennese roots is that it became the only one of Puccini's operas not to be published by Ricordi, instead being issued by their longtime rival, Sonzogno. The autograph was therefore long considered destroyed in the Allied bombing of Milan in 1943, which obliterated much of Sonzogno's archive. This, however, has proved a false assumption. In recent years, the autograph was revealed among the documents in the possession of the composer's final descendant, Simonetta Puccini. In plot terms, this original Rondine, 1914-17, is very much an early version of the standard first edition, the one familiar in classic recordings conducted by Francesco Molinari Pradelli, Lauren Mazel, and Antonio Pappano. But musically, the original Rondine also contains hundreds of fascinating differences. These range from small-scale tweaks in the vocal lines, text, dynamics, phrasing, and articulation, to entire sections that were cut or rewritten for the published edition. What's more, some of these early ideas that Puccini rejected in 1917 would later make their way into his 1919 and 1922 revisions, revealing that, while Puccini may have abandoned them in 1917, certain musical ideas continued to haunt him more than 5 years later. This original version is to receive its premiere this month at the Teatro alla Scala under Riccardo Chailly in a new production by Irina Brook to mark Puccini's centenary, thus revealing Puccini's earliest vision of La Rondine for the first time in over a century. From the outset, the development of La Rondine was marked by questions about genre. The work was commissioned by Vienna's Karl Theater as an operetta, an offer made while Puccini was visiting in late 1913 for the first Austrian performance of La Fanciulla dell'Ovest. Puccini was soon sent a pitch for a work, which he immediately rejected as the usual sloppy and banal operetta, with the usual East and West contrast, declaring that he would never compose an operetta, but instead do something like Rosenkavalier, but more entertaining and more organic. He then accepted an outline by Alfred Maria Wilner and Heinz Reichardt for a plot that clearly matched his tastes more closely. This outline was translated, freely adapted and versified by Adami, with a degree of license that led to strong disagreements between the three men responsible for the libretto. In broad terms, however, Rondinet's plot was clearly still shaped by Viennese operetta. Vilner was already established as a librettist for Lehár, Leo Fall, and Oscar Strauss, including hits such as Der Graf von Luxemburg and Die Dollar Prinzessin. And Rondinet's libretto in all its versions features typical operetta traits. Most obviously, the opera features the usual lead voice types of Silver Age operetta: two sopranos, a tenor, and a character tenor or baritone, a maid in disguise, Lisette, that directly alludes to Strauss's Die Fledermaus, 1874, and a central dance scene in Paris that delights in the sights and sounds of modern nightlife. In Puccini's hands, this setting also encouraged the use of waltzes, as well as the fashionable American dance music of the day, one-steps and tangos, which Lehár would himself mine from the 1920s onwards. But the opera's plot also clearly referenced more tragic Italian and French works, particularly Verdi's La Traviata, 1853, and Massenet's Sappho, 1897. This ambivalence would give La Rondinée its unique character and shape its reception for decades to come, while seeding doubts in the composer's mind that were never entirely resolved. Puccini's letters reveal that composing Rondinet was fraught with difficulties. How should this opera, so playful, sparkling, and wistful in its first two acts, resolve itself in the final act, given the heroine's destiny to return to Paris? Should Magda break off the relationship, or is Ruggiero genuinely horrified by her past? A letter from Vilner to Puccini in 1919 reveals that the Viennese librettists had originally imagined a tragic ending for the work, similar to the one used in the third edition, with Ruggiero violently rejecting Magda. The solution arrived at by Puccini and Adami in 1914-17 instead has Prunier play an important role in reminding Magda of her previous life, the farewell between Magda and Ruggiero allowing the heroine to play an almost maternal role in their goodbye. Once a decision had been made and the autograph completed in April 1916, however, Puccini would wait nearly a year until its premiere. As usual, he attended the rehearsals in Monte Carlo, and he clearly made some changes and cuts to the autograph version at this stage. But the first edition was published only several months later, at a time when Puccini also donated 8 pages of the autograph to Bologna's conservatory, in a clear sign that this original version was no longer the standard reference point. What then does the original Rondinet sound like? The first major difference comes early on, in the opera's great hit, Che bel sogno di Doretta. As usually known, this soprano aria is preceded by a verse for Prunier. He is unable to complete his new poem about Doretta, and this aria introduces one of the opera's recurrent musical themes, a falling sequence first heard on solo violin that also concludes Act One, as Magda dresses up to go to the party at Boulier. In the standard Rondinet, Prunier's verse is followed by Magda's, who completes the story he cannot conclude, the aria's final bars reintroducing the love theme from the opera's own overture and fusing together Magda's and Doretta's identities. Yet, in the original Rondinet, Prunier in fact sings a second verse before Magda takes over, extending his story of the attempted seduction of Doretta by various suitors who offer her material comfort. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.